The headlines, a civilian contractor is killed in a rocket attack targeting Iraq's Ain al-Assad airbase that hosts American forces. Iran's president says preserving the 2015 nuclear deal is possible only if its signatories take practical measures, noting that the U.S. has failed to take any steps to remove its sanctions on Tehran. Myanmar's security forces shoot to death at least 9 people during the latest protests against a recent military coup. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour. Rockets have hit Ain al-Assad Air Base in western Iraq, which hosts foreign forces including U.S. troops. The U.S. said 10 rockets targeted the base. Iraqi security sources said a civilian contractor was killed. There's no immediate claim of responsibility. American forces and their supply convoys have been targeted by dozens of attacks in Iraq in recent months. In February, a rocket attack on U.S.-led forces in northern Iraq killed a civilian contractor and injured a U.S. service member. Such attacks have taken place amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq. The sentiments grew after the U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January last year. Baghdad-based reporter from IRIB Bureau, Navid Behrouz, earlier joined us and gave us details about the latest attack on Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq.
10 rockets of the Katyusha type were fired from the Al-Bayadir hit, which is located near this base. Those rockets were fired from that area and targeted Ain al-Assad Air Base. 10 Katyusha rockets hit that base. Based on the incoming reports, they landed at the southern part of the air base, that is where the dormitory of American forces is located, and immediately after the attack, we witnessed sorties and flights by American helicopters and aircraft over the Ain al-Assad air base, and also columns of smoke were seen rising from Ain al-Assad base. The eyewitnesses are saying that so far no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and this attack definitely was in response to an earlier attack last week by the U.S. against the popular mobilization units forces here in the same province, Al-Anbar province. It happened on the Iraqi soil. This attack is in response to that attack, and resistance groups had already announced that they would respond to the U.S. attack. So this attack is probably a response to the U.S. attack, and that proves that resistance groups have proved that they are capable of responding to American attacks despite all security measures adopted by the U.S. military in that area.
Iran's president says there needs to be practical measures by all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to preserve the landmark accord.
The European parties to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action say we must preserve the deal. Okay, if rhetoric helps, we say it louder. But with words and slogans, the standoff will not be resolved. The Americans are just paying lip service. They say they want to rejoin the JCPOA, but words are not enough. There must be actions.
Rouhani said the United States has not taken any considerable steps to remove its sanctions on Iran. He added that the current U.S. administration should strongly denounce its predecessor's actions against Iran if it deems them wrong. He called on Washington to return to its commitments under the JCPOA. Rouhani said the standoff over the accord can be resolved easily if the U.S. lifts all sanctions, and then Iran will return to full compliance. Former U.S. President Donald Trump walked out of the multilateral accord in 2018 and reinstated tough sanctions on Iran. A year later, Iran began reducing its obligations. Former U.N. Special Rapporteur Mr. Alfred de Zayas joins us now from Geneva. Sir, welcome to the program. Let's go over the comments made by the Iranian president. Mr. Rouhani says that there needs to be practical measures by all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to preserve the landmark accord. That's a pragmatic approach, isn't it?
Well, that's common sense. The entire international community is interested and will benefit from reaffirming this 2015 accord. the withdrawal by President Trump in 2018, of course, violated the principle of good faith. It violated the principle pacta sunt servanda, meaning agreements have to be implemented. Now, in the spirit of the United Nations Charter, in particular Articles 2, Paragraph 3, and Articles 2, Paragraph 4, what we need here is negotiation in good faith, and the Europeans want it. The Europeans want to maintain the agreement, and I think that this agreement is very much in the spirit of the non-proliferation treaties, in the spirit of the treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons, which entered into force on the 22nd of January of this year. It is entirely possible for President Joe Biden to lift the sanctions. And I think there's an important element here. The United Nations rapporteur on the adverse impact of unilateral coercive measures has already repeatedly condemned unilateral coercive measures, meaning sanctions. Already the first rapporteur, Dr. Idris Yazaidi, the second rapporteur, Professor Alena Dohan. I myself condemned them in my 6 years as rapporteur because sanctions kill. It would be important for the Iranians, it was important for the Syrians, for the Venezuelans, for the Cubans, to quantify the damage, especially now during the COVID pandemic. It is evident that if you impose sanctions on a country, the ability of that country to defend itself and to protect the health of its population is diminished because of the impact of the sanctions. So there's a nexus between sanctions and death, and that should be brought to the attention of world public opinion. It's not just theoretically saying sanctions are an unfriendly act. No, sanctions kill. And this is something that should be before the International Criminal Court as a crime against humanity under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome. All of that, I mean, I have written it, and Alena Dohan has written it, and Idris Yazaidi has written it, but there's been no follow-up. We hear lip service from Joe Biden. I'm an American citizen. I asked Joe Biden to actually take action and lift the sanctions so that we can go forward with an agreement that was negotiated over a very long period of time, and an agreement that, in my opinion, makes a lot of sense.
All right, thanks a lot. Former UN Special Rapporteur Mr. Alfred de Zeis joining us from Geneva. Elsewhere, Russia has slammed as absolutely unacceptable the latest sanctions the U.S. and EU announced over the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin said the sanctions amount to interference in Russia's domestic affairs. It said Russia would take reciprocal steps in a way that best serves its interests. Earlier, the foreign ministry also warned the U.S. not to play with fire. It said the sanctions were evidence of a hostile anti-Russian lunge. The U.S. and the European Union imposed penalties on a number of Russian government officials and entities on Tuesday. The two say the Russian government was behind the last year poisoning of Navalny. Moscow strongly denies that. Dutch police say an explosion has hit a coronavirus testing center in a town north of the capital Amsterdam. Authorities have cordoned off the blast site to carry out an investigation. Police say the explosion broke windows but caused no injuries. They say the incident is likely to be intentional. In January, another coronavirus testing center was set on fire in central Netherlands. That incident came after several nights of violent protests against tougher COVID-19 restrictions, including overnight curfews. Media reports say at least 9 people have been killed during the latest anti-coup protests in Myanmar, where the military has intensified its crackdown on protesters. The victims lost their lives in different cities. Their deaths bring to 30 the number of people killed across Myanmar since the anti-coup rallies began early last month. The military alleged that November elections had been rigged It detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint. The president is now facing two new charges. The junta has also charged six journalists over their coverage of the protests. On Tuesday, a regional diplomatic push to help end the month-long crisis made little headway. International human rights lawyer Edward Corian says the charges leveled by Myanmar's junta against ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi are unfounded.
But these are trumped-up charges. They're baseless, and actually they're ridiculous. But, you know, the UN Security Council has not taken a strong stand, and we have to wait and see what the American and British and other Western corporations, if they think they can make money there. The junta wants to maintain the power that they've had in the past. They had held Suu Kyi in house arrest for 6 years. The Myanmar military, it's like a separate institution. It runs parallel to the government, but it's not really controlled by the government. And it's also one of the largest armies in the world, even though Myanmar is a relatively poor country. So the military has tremendous power and control. And I think they were shocked that Suu Kyi's party, League for Democracy, National League for Democracy, had won a strong mandate in the elections that were held in November of last year. So they fabricate this excuse, as far as I'm concerned, that there was fraud in the election, but I've seen no evidence of fraud.
Stranded migrants have demonstrated in Mexico's city of Tijuana on the U.S. border. They've called on the new U.S. administration to let them enter the country. The migrants demanded entry despite having no active cases in migrant protection protocols. That's a program launched under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It forced more than 65,000 asylum seekers back to Mexico while their cases were being heard by U.S. immigration courts. The Biden administration has reversed Trump's policy, but for now it's only processing active cases. Migrants without such cases have been waiting months in the Mexican camps. They are mainly from Central American countries and want to enter the U.S. in search of a better life. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has stressed the importance of what he called a return to democracy in Venezuela through free and fair elections. Blinken made the comment as he spoke with Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido. The top U.S. diplomat described his country's efforts with other groups to increase pressure for power transition in Venezuela. In January 2019, Guaido declared himself president. He argued President Nicolas Maduro's re-election a year earlier was fraudulent. The U.S. and the EU threw their support behind Guaido. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on the Venezuelan government, including measures targeting the oil sector. President Maduro says the U.S. is seeking to overthrow his government, with Guaido being a puppet of Washington. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has unanimously approved William Burns to become the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Senator Mark Warner, the Democratic chair of the committee, says a veteran diplomat has, quote, unquestioned qualifications for the position. The bipartisan approval clears a path to a full Senate vote on President Joe Biden's pick to lead the CIA. Burns, 64 years old, is a former deputy secretary of state and ambassador to Russia and Jordan. At a confirmation hearing last month, he called China's leadership the biggest geopolitical test for the U.S. Burns said gathering intelligence on China would be a priority for the CIA. A major Canadian advocacy group has accused authorities in the country of turning a blind eye to increasing violence against Muslim women. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
A major Muslim organization in Canada has called for the immediate creation of a bipartisan committee to deal with racist and Islamophobic crimes in the country. National Council of Canadian Muslims says racism is a real problem in Canada. Now, the advocacy group has accused authorities of turning a blind eye to the crisis. Remarks follow a spate of recent attacks against black Muslims. Five Somali-Canadian Muslim women were assaulted in the city of Edmonton in the past 10 weeks. Last year, more than 60 such crimes were reported in the city. And now joining us for this news review is Robert Fan, Tina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Firas Al-Naji, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Firas, we're going to start with you, if it's okay. Firas, you know, I was basically looking at all the Islamophobic attack on Muslim women in Canada from 2008 to recently. There's tons of them, malls, universities out on the streets with their kids, getting punched in the faces, getting their hijab pulled off. This is obviously a huge problem, not just with respect to Somali women, but it's a problem against Muslim people in general. What's going on in Canada?
Yes, I mean, this has been ongoing for many years. I mean, and the media has a big role in this, because the media, especially from the States, has a big influence on the Canadian media as well, because people watch all the news from North America. Tyrant Trump, you know, in his administration and his arrogance, he was very Islamophobic. His administration always spoke in ways, Fox News, even the news in Canada, a lot of it is Islamophobic. There's a lot of Islamophobia in there, you know, and they try to label Muslims as terrorists. And the word, for instance, Islamist is always affiliated with terrorism. And Islamist means a person that is Islamic, you know what I mean? So when you use that word and you keep deliberately using that word, it causes people to affiliate always Islamic a religion with terrorism or with extremism or with radicalism or with attacks and things like that. So they've really kind of embedded this in people's mentalities, and unfortunately there is a lot of hate crimes that are happening everywhere. Now there's a the most people I think that actually get attacked are females, unfortunately, right? Because they're more vulnerable. They're, you know, people think that they're easier to attack, and the women in Canada have to always prove their innocence in a way. They have to always show that, you know, we're not here to impose our Sharia law. We're not here to, we're not abused at home. We're not discriminated by our husbands, you know, because of this narratives that they sell on media and different places. This needs to be combated. This is a very delayed process now. I mean, Islamophobia itself should be a hate crime that is described in detail, and there should be a law that is adopted as a criminal code to have people arrested and charged on this. I would like to also say that the Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, I would have to say, in this perspective, on this file, he's done a pretty good job. I mean, when there was an attack in Montreal, in Quebec, I mean, and they attacked a mosque, and there was, you know, it was a massacre, it was a tragic, and he called it a terrorist attack. And that's, in our modern time, that was the first time I hear a Western leader pretty much call a white supremacist, non-Muslim attacker a terrorist.
Thank you, Firaz. And Robert, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Your thoughts on the rap that Canadian Muslims are receiving, and what more the government can do to address it. And to Firaz's point, I mean, we have anti-Semitism to protect Jews. Why can't Islamophobia be a law that anti-Muslim? Why can't Islamophobia be a crime that protects Muslims?
It should absolutely be a crime, and these assaults on these women should all be prosecuted as hate crimes. As Firaz said, a Muslim woman have to prove themselves to people that they are simply minding their own business, they're not terrorists, and so on, and that is totally wrong. They shouldn't have to prove anything more than any other woman in Canada has to prove, and that's simply that they have nothing to prove. They're just going about their business, living their lives, regardless of whether they wear a hijab or not. It's just, these are Canadians, they're entitled to live in Canada just like anybody else, and should be able to walk the streets at any time they want to without fear of this violence that has been coming up on them. The government needs to make Islamophobic crimes hate crimes. It needs to speak out more forcefully about Islamophobia and condemn it more, whether it's mentioned in Parliament or whether they see it on news programs talking about or equating Muslims with terrorists. This is simply wrong. It's very typical in the United States, certainly, but it has no place there or in Canada. Canadian self-image is that of openness and tolerance, but these crimes belie that image, and they need to be addressed, and these crimes need to be addressed very firmly, very strongly, and promptly when they occur.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Pleasure to have you both on the program once again. Robert Fantina from Kitchener, Ontario, and Firazad Najim joining us there out of Ottawa. And that's a wrap for the segment here for News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We have been discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 in Nahj al-Balagha. Of course, according to other counts, it is sermon number 192 or 93 also. It is famously known as the sermon of the pious people. In this sermon, Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions about the various different qualities that a pious person needs to have. One of those qualities that he mentions is a pious person controls his food intake. He says mazuran aklu, that means his eating is controlled and it is less rather. And in this, of course, we discussed about some of the narrations that talk about the dangers, the physical and spiritual dangers of gluttony. And we saw that how gluttony actually takes you away from spirituality and from coming close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And rather controlling it and having a controlled diet whereby a person does not transgress his limits and does not, you know, overeat. Rather, even tries his best to be meager in his eating. It will really create an effect in his heart and in his soul and in his existence. Of course, by keeping in mind the recommendations of the health practitioners.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we reached the discussion of controlling our food intake. But now, one of the important discussions that come up here is what are the practical methods of avoiding overeating. What do we do? Because there are people who have tried their best to stop overeating, but unfortunately they end up overeating. It is a common problem, and it needs, of course, some practical solutions. One of the very good practical solutions is basically the mustahabbat, or the recommended practices that are there in the Sharia. There are very many recommended practices that actually help a person control their food intake and rather avoid overeating. So for example, in the narrations we have that a person should chew 40 times, let's say 40 could be an allusion towards a good number of times, to chew the food properly until it is ground nicely and then swallowing the food. Unfortunately, in some people you'll see the practice is just gobbling the food rather, and like taking up large morsels that enter into the stomach while they are still formed, like they're not, they haven't yet been ground at all. I'm not saying that we should you know, chew the food until it becomes completely fluid and liquid. We don't say that. I mean, but chewing the food itself has a lot of benefits scientifically. It allows the saliva to act on the food. It, when the food enters the stomach, also the enzymes can easily work on the food, and the digestion process also increases. So there are various benefits of eating food while chewing the food, basically. This is one example of the recommended acts that we have in the Sharia.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Another example of a recommended act that helps would help control the food intake and rather control gluttony would be the issue of eating when you eat with your, let's say, with your hand. It is recommended that you use 3 fingers or 4 fingers. That means your morsels have to be little, they have to be small. They don't have to be large morsels. Okay, for example, some people when they eat with their hands, they eat with the whole palm. Like they take the whole right palm and they put it inside the food, and like they have a whole palm full of, a handful of food, and they put it inside their mouths. Okay, this is not recommended. Basically, you're supposed to take small morsels. Now, you've noticed all these processes are there to kind of increase the amount of time you take to eat the food, right? To eat a small amount of food, but at a slower pace of time. And therefore, it allows the mind and the brain to get acquainted with the fact that there is food in the stomach. Scientifically speaking, when already the stomach is full, the message of whether the stomach is full or not is sent, like it's felt a bit later than when the stomach is already full, when the appetite is already killed. See? So normally what happens is people, when they're eating fast and they're eating very quickly and they're not concentrating and they're not chewing their food, a very large amount of food enters their stomach and they still feel that they are hungry. Rather, they are not hungry. But if they take their time and they control that, you know, that urge to eat quickly, you will notice that they will have greater control over their food. You see, scientifically also, you know, psychologically speaking, when you want to control and you want to win, or you want to, you can say, have victory over a large thing, you need to start having victory, tasting victory in small, small paces. Even, for example, when you have a large task to do, let's say you have to clean up the whole house, right? So you might look at your home and see, oh my God, everything is out of place here. Yeah? But what you do is that you take small steps. So you say, okay, right now I'm just going to clean. Let's say I'm going to pick up the toys, or let's say I'm going to pick up the clothes, or I'll pick up the clothes that are, let's say, on this side of the room. So I put small objectives in my mind, and after you accomplish one of your objectives, you feel good about it, and then it increases like that. So basically, when a person eats in small morsels and continues to chew his food and takes his time, he's giving himself the opportunity to slowly get his body to get acquainted to controlling of that desire and therefore have control over the food intake. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we are able to apply some of the teachings of Islam so that we can achieve fighting over and winning over the vice of gluttony. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال هناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel.
Israel is ever closer to another election. It would be the fourth one in 2 years. A preliminary date has been set for March 16, 2021. A majority of Israeli lawmakers voted to dissolve parliament in a preliminary reading.
Unfortunately, and I'm saying the truth, Benny Gantz reneged on the agreements between us, and this decision is dragging the state of Israel into elections. And I think it happened, and this isn't a secret, because of an internal fight in his party. He reneged because of his insistence to continue giving Nissenkorn, against the coalition agreement, to advance a dictatorship of left-wing bureaucrats, and these bureaucrats are ruining the will of the people.
This brings Israel closer to its fourth round of elections in 2 years. Disagreements over the 2020 budget have caused the latest political turmoil. The main issue is that the Israeli coalition cabinet can't really agree on anything. Israeli ministers accuse Israel Israel's prime minister of lying and sidelining his demands, in particular, a proposed budget, the same budget that hasn't been passed. Another election means Israelis have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for it. Israel's elections are costly. They run upwards of $400 million per election. About 30% of that money, according to Channel 12, will go to party funding. Another 20% will go to party member loans. Israel has had three so far in less than 2 years. According to the Manufacturers Association of Israel, the latest three elections cost Israelis $3.8 billion. This calculation factors in the expense of election days that require businesses to close for the day. In Israel, any election day is a national holiday to facilitate voting. If businesses still open, according to the Israeli law, they need to pay their employees 200% of their normal salary for the day. The Calculation Manufacturers Association of Israel also includes party campaign budgets funded by Israel and the cost of operating the Central Elections Committee, which oversees the electoral process. Furthermore, with caretaker cabinets in place since December 2018, Israel's economic policies have been on hold, while the debt increased and costs continued. Costs incurred by the ongoing political maneuvering and ultimate stalemate that exist following the latest election results may be compounded by yet another election soon. The lack of a budget law has hurt the most vulnerable worst of all. The lack of a state budget has left working parents, especially lower-income ones, with no immediate solutions to the problem.
You know, it's a lot of money, but I have to be frank with you and the audience. I want to say that this will bring problems and more crises to the citizens of Israel, but it's not the main crisis in Israel. We can see now this cost of the new campaign and the election will make the crisis wider from one side and deeper from other side. It means that we are already in the crisis, and the election will bring more problems and to make this crisis wider and deeper. You know, everybody, that the election, this the fourth one in less than 2 years, is out of the complicated crisis politically, economically, and the health and the corruption crisis in Israel. It's a reflex of this crisis. There is a new phenomena of this fourth election, different than the last three elections. In the last three elections, the main discussion were between the right-wing parties, Netanyahu and the Likud, and from the other side, the center and left forces and parties in, for example, Gantz and the Labour Party and the Meretz and the Common List in the Arab side. But this election is not between these two forces, the right and the, from one side, and the center left in the other side. Now the discussion, the main fight is between the right parties from the other side, other right parties, between the right parties together. And this is a new phenomena. Wasn't in all the history of Israel from the first election on 1949 till now.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Philippe says, now Israeli elections coming up and have to watch all this over recharge stuff again. Likud will win again. Benjamin says he's Israeli. The elections are not a big deal. Netanyahu is facing elections also. It's all a ploy. Yonah says, Israeli elections are almost officially back for the fourth time in 2 years. Preliminary date of March 16 set. This is the timing Blue and White wanted and not later in the spring post-vaccination that Likud wanted. Though not clear, Blue and White will do any better.
Quite clear that the Israeli economy is going to pay and is already paying a very heavy price for having a fourth elections in 2 years. But what many people overlook is the moral, psychological, and the motivational damage that is being caused, because there's a large number of people from the Israeli middle class. And it doesn't really matter if it's center-left or center-right, who still believe that Israel is a Western, democratic, Zionist, normal state. And they still believe in the institutions of this state. And what they are discovering, or will discover, is that on top of the pyramid sits a man who will do everything in his ability to remain in power and will subvert the economic and political and justice system of the country. He will undermine it to achieve his goal. At the moment, Israel's debt lies at 14.5% of its GDP. Unemployment is at 20%. Poverty is at 29%. Israelis don't need new elections at this time that will cost $400 million. What they need is good governance, and they need a budget, because there hasn't been a budget for 2020, nor for 2021. Nevertheless, elections are being held, and that is due to Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on having a one-year budget plan. Netanyahu insisted on having a one-year budget plan, although he agreed to have a two-year budget plan earlier, because he wanted to have absolute control over the situation.
Israelis are upset about this because, according to KAN, the same troublemakers and lawmakers and officials in the Israeli cabinet and Knesset who are calling for a fourth election are the ones who benefit and are in some way rewarded for such political standoffs. And now they're going to get a reward for trying to convince Israelis to pick them again using their own tax money. Many of the members in the Knesset and the cabinet have been there running for their seats since the first election out of three seemingly failed ones. Israelis have lost confidence in them. It seems that no matter how much money is spent on their campaigns and how much fiscal funding they receive courtesy of Israeli taxpayers, they can't even pass a budget that will allow Israelis and Israel in general to function. Israelis believe that this is what the regime wanted. A fourth election looms because it is the only mechanism available to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to call new elections. For Netanyahu, a fourth race in under 2 years would have him not cede his office in November 2021 to his rival-turned-partner, Military Minister Benny Gantz. Netanyahu and Gantz have been circling each other for months. Netanyahu has been seeking to escape the clauses of his coalition agreement. Gantz has been struggling to hold him to it, and the budget has served as the main leverage in that fight. This leaves the Israeli public to be the outcast in all of this, while they bear the biggest brunt. Hence, protesters, which are at their 28th week of protests, are calling for the downfall of the regime, simply because they have had enough.
It means the mass of the citizens of Israel are the main loser. But if we take it in the between parties and politically, we can see that Gantz and the Labour Party. It means the center and left, who were inside the coalition government, they will be the main loser as the political parties. The second loser will be Netanyahu himself, not the right wing as a political platform, but as the struggle against the corruption of Netanyahu. You know, and everybody knows that he is facing three corruption cases in the court. They didn't reach to this budget because they know that the budget must bring a new hard decisions against the most of the citizens and the businesses out of the situation. They connect that with the political crisis in Israel and with the personal crisis of Netanyahu himself toward the corruption cases which he faced this time. For this reason, the budget issue is a symptom of the deep and wide, multiple and complicated crisis which Israel facing. This complicated crisis in Israel since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 wasn't in this thing. But there is a part of this crisis were something the same. I want to remember, let's remember together, for example. If we are talking about the political crisis, we saw a political crisis before, like what was in Barak on 1999 in Camp David. And it was a big political crisis in that time that was in Israel. If we are talking about the economical crisis, we can see two main crises in the history in economics. One, it was in 1985, and the second in 2008.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Classical Lib asks, how many ex-Likudniks have created a new party because Bibi pushed them out? 10 or something like that, right? Noah says, Israel needs a new party, but not with the same old collection of egomaniacs. Michael jokingly says, due to the directives against large gatherings, maybe there should be a directive that no political party can have more than 10 candidates.
Government don't care about the citizens in Israel, and we feel all the corruption in the government taking us down. And Israel is a proud country. We are a proud people who try to save our free and democratic only country in the Middle East. And because of this, the people of Israel is arising against the government.
What took place within the Israeli parliament most recently was that there was a vote to postpone reaching a decision regarding the budget. And while historically and most recently there's been a very strong opposition to Prime Minister Netanyahu from the center and from the left, now there's been a rebellion from the right, and there were members of the ruling Likud party, of all parties, who actually quit and either joined a new party, or people from the right who were surprised by voting against the proposition. And that is, this is what is enabling a fourth election. So in fact, there is a growing number of people who believe that they can unseat Netanyahu and remove him, and believe that they could serve as better prime ministers. And it is their personal drive that is causing Israel to go for a fourth election. The reason elections are being held on such a frequent basis in Israel is due to the fact that there isn't a clear consensus. Israeli society is deeply fragmented and divided. Various political parties are pushing in various different directions. Due to the fact that Israel is a so-called democracy, because it's democracy for Jews only, but it's a parliamentary democracy, various parties can pull out when they wish and therefore bring down the coalition once a majority is not secured. And that gives increasing power to smaller political parties. The polarization within Israel is getting stronger and deeper, and elections are therefore being held on a more frequent basis as various parties and figures split, and even within these splits, there are various new splits.
To make matters even worse, in a recent speech, Israeli Military Minister Benny Gantz told Israelis on live national TV that he knew Netanyahu is a serial promise breaker, and that Netanyahu lied to Israelis and did not lie to Benny Gantz, even though he formed a coalition with him. So-called Knesset opposition leader Yair Lapid said citizens shared the feeling that they lost control over their lives. The lack of budget for 2020 has contributed to hardships and cutbacks for Israelis, amid unemployment estimated at over 20%. It seems that as the new year looms, so does another election for Israel. The same parties and the same players are on the table. The only thing new would be the money that would have went to a 2020 budget. Now, it remains to be seen if a budget would ever get passed. This, all the while Israelis suffer. Here is the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Israel's malls warn they will not close during new coronavirus restrictions. The operators of Israel's malls said that they would not close their doors again if instructed to do so, as part of tighter measures to reduce the rising coronavirus infection rate. Haaretz. Ministries will be forced to cut their budgets in January by about a quarter of planned levels, a total of 10 billion shekels or $3.1 billion, bringing many regime activities to a standstill, an analysis by the finance ministry's accountant general has found. I-24 News. A survey released shows that more than a quarter of a million Israeli households have fallen below the poverty line since the start of the lockdown responses to the pandemic, an increase of almost 50%. According to the welfare charity Leitet, which also provides meal services throughout Israel, approximately 3 in 10 Israelis, 29.3%, live in poverty, which equates to 850,000 households. That figure represents more than a 9% year-on-year increase, 20.1%. The Jerusalem Post. Some 63% of Israelis plan on being vaccinated against the coronavirus, but only 24% of them plan on getting the vaccine immediately, a new poll published by Ynet News has found. One possible explanation for the relatively low number of Israelis willing to be vaccinated immediately is the public's opinion of the safety of the vaccine. Some 23% of Israelis don't know if the vaccine is safe, 17% think it is not safe, and 6% are sure it is not safe, according to the Ynet poll.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.